This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, listener, it's your host, Nick, here with a quick message before the show. If you enjoy this episode, learn something new, or just feel like helping us out, please consider following the show, subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, leaving us a 5-star review, or sharing this episode. All of these things greatly help the Birdshot Podcast and allow us to reach more and more listeners just like yourself. I would appreciate you taking just a minute to do any of those things. And if you really love the show and you want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, subscribing, and following, you could consider becoming a Patreon contributor, which gets you some exclusive discounts and promotions, some bonus content from time to time. You'd be eligible for any and all Patreon giveaways. And last but hopefully not least, I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me for your support of the show. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And with that said, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome to the Birdshot Podcast, buddy.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for joining me. It's been kind of a long time coming. Adair's been telling me I should get you on the show for like years now. So I finally had a chance to come down and meet you and hang with the crew down there in South Carolina, pretty close to your home, I suppose. And figured it would be a good time to get you on and we could recap the St. Hubert's trial a little bit and talk about other things. But we're both getting snowed on today. That's kind of probably not too common to have both of us getting snow at the same time, you being in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's a bit weird for us. So we had a hard cold January for us, but this is our second snow of the year. And every time, I mean, I don't even know if it's accumulated yet, but the kids out of school, we're all worried about what we got to do to shift our schedules around tomorrow. So yeah, the world kind of comes to a standstill with any snow here.
So snow day in North Carolina versus snow day in Minnesota looks a little bit different.
I'd reckon.
You guys already have school canceled tomorrow?
I don't think they've done it yet, but I mean, okay. It's a given. So
yeah,
if not canceled, it'll certainly be on a delay. We're kind of hovering around freezing right now, which is, you know, nobody wants to go outside.
So yeah, I love it. Yeah. We're just about to climb out of another Arctic blast. Has been really cold here this week. And I do know my son is on winter break this week, but I know that some schools were canceled this week due to cold, not so much snow, but just really, really cold, sub-zero temps. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I'm sure it gets dangerous to have the kids out there in that weather.
Yeah. You know, when I'm standing at the bus stop and all that stuff, but my son he's actually at an outdoor camp this week. So we're making the most of it. It's going to warm up here in the next couple of days. I'm sure you guys will be getting that too. But anyways, yeah, it was when I was down there a couple of weeks ago, I think the Sunday of the St. Hubert's trial, I think it was like 78 degrees. So I hadn't felt temps like that in quite a while. And it wasn't the best for dog, you know, running dogs and stuff, but we all made do. But that was a beautiful day. And then I came home to like 20 below. So it was like 100 degree difference in 48 hours.
Yeah, it was a miserable day for bird dogging. I mean, it was a pretty day to stand around and hang out, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's unseasonable for here, but it was, you know, we're all, I think, you know, these late February kind of warm spells or mid-February warm spells kind of get everybody in that spring fever mindset. And, and so when we get the return of the cold weather, you know, we're all dreading it.
Yeah. What's the status as far as hunting seasons? Like, you guys kind of just finish up. I know woodcock seasons are they closed, open? What's the status right now?
Yeah, woodcock season goes out. Duck and woodcock go out at the end of January.
Okay.
Quail still in. I haven't really I haven't really hunted February. I kind of start picking back up with training again.
Yeah.
You know, the some other general small game. I do have a snipe hunt planned for Friday if we get there.
Nice.
You know, so we still have a few things on the menu, but we're winding down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, woodcock is, you know, woodcock's the real busy time for us. And then when that goes out, it's, you know, picking and choosing.
Does, now being that you're not getting snowed out of the covers normally, like we would up here, if, you know, hunting season ends, but do folks kind of continue to run wild birds? Do you lay off, or what's the opportunity there?
I mess with them a little bit. Usually by the time January's closing up, I've thoroughly worn my dogs out. You know, we'll go out and pick at them a little bit. It'd be a little different if, you know, I wish we had them around like March, but it's really just kind of letting them lick their wounds and, you know, and kind of recover for a week or two before I get back in the woods. I will mess with them. We live in a pretty neat spot. We have a swamp about 500 yards out the back door and a big cornfield between here and there. And so, you know, on a warm evening out here right now, they're sky dancing and
really,
yeah, it's a,
okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but they're all kind of gearing up for the return flight and you can feel it. The ducks are all kind of getting fewer and further between. So, you know, it's, but they're still around and I, you know, we have a resident population. And I've got friends that are like, man, as soon as it starts warming up in February, they just stay off them just in case they're starting to nest or anything.
Yeah.
I assume they probably wouldn't make it considering it's going to get wet and cold again at least one more time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of, I was curious as far as like flyway stage, like are you in an area where they pass through? Are they kind of there all the time? You know, my understanding is they kind of go south for the winter, but then they'll sort of move around a little bit.
Yeah, it depends on where you are. I'm sure we have birds. You know, we'll get really heavy flights. So there will be times, and it's really hard to predict. You know, it's not always with the weather. We're on a down here for me. I think it's the watershed plays a big role. You know, the riverine systems and stuff kind of are where I think the flyways concentrate, and there's certain areas that tend to hold more birds than others. You know, but certainly noticeable on the river, you know, if you're hunting in that big buffer that I would consider like the Yadkin drainage where I live, you know, the birds, you might go out there and just hit a big fall of them one day and go out and they're gone the next. But if you kind of remain in the watershed, you kind of learn where you can expect to see birds throughout the season. But it is interesting is, you know, I'll follow the river all the way south of here down into South Carolina as the season draws on, and you can kind of see the birds accumulating at what I would consider their terminus down there. So it's, you know, it's fun to kind of guess at what's going on with the flight and you know, everything else. But I know I've got one that peints every night, every year out of the same exact spot, you know, and you can kind of, I don't think that bird ever, I don't know if it's a resident or if it just has parked here for years and its grandpa did, and, you know, it just sits out there. So
that would be, I would not be disappointed if I had, you know, almost sort of year round painting and not obviously sky dancing, but to have them around, it's a comforting feeling, you know, to have the woodcock around and when it's getting dim at night and dusk and you start hearing that painting. I mean, I'm looking forward to that now.
Yeah.
Because that's a sign of spring for me. So
exactly. And that's kind of how it is down here. It feels good to just sit out at dusk and kind of watch them do their thing and listen for them. And I think last year, just without trying, just training dogs in the back, I think I flushed one as late as like mid April here. And so I have no idea what his deal was or where he was going, but yeah, they're here.
Yeah.
It's fun to kind of pay attention to them.
Sort of a bird of mystery in some ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's cool. So you did go, you went down to Siwi. Anything noteworthy there? Do you go down for the people watching, for the shopping? What's your agenda?
I, this was the first year I was able to talk my wife into it. She kind of avoids all the, well, I say that she went down with me a few years ago. We actually had a booth for the French Brittany Club.
Okay.
And I've been back since. She hasn't. But it's grown in popularity, man. And so we went down, just really had a few people I wanted to meet and shake some hands, and got to do that. And that was nice, but it was so crowded at Brittlebank, which is really, I think, the one that draws everybody. And we went to the other ones, but I'm lucky that my sister lives in Charleston, and you know, we just kind of turned it more into a family visit. We went out for a couple hours and picked up our stickers and, you know, shook the hands, and we just, you know, went and hung out with my sister and kind of avoided the crowds. I'm not much of a crowd guy, depending on the context.
Anyway. It's like a fine line, you know. It can be, if all of a sudden you can't move and can't even look at stuff, then it gets to be a little bit much.
But I mean, it's cool. It's so cool, and it's so neat. It's so worth going anyway. And obviously, you know, there's more to it than just Brittlebank. It really takes over the entire, you know, city of Charleston. And I think they said that there were 40,000 people that came in over the weekend, which is, you know,
wow.
Charleston's a big city as it is, but you could definitely feel the pressure of the added, you know, people in town.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's cool. I went 2 years ago, or last year, not this year. And, you know, I was just down there, but if I had my way and we could really creatively schedule it, it would have been fun to come down there for the St. Hubert's event, hang around, maybe chase some birds, do some stuff during the week, and then land at Seawee. But it just wasn't in the cards for us this year. But who knows, maybe next year. And if the timing works out on both those events, I do enjoy coming down there. I mean, you get out of Minnesota for a week or so and get to see some cool places. But I mean, there's just so much, the history and the culture with bird dogs and the field trial grounds. I kind of want to talk to you about that a little bit. Like, it just, it was really, really neat to go down there. And even though I didn't get to go to Seawee this year, just to get back down to that part of the world and obviously participate in the St. Hubert's trial, it was a blast. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I this year, to me, you know, I mean, it just has, hopefully it continues on that trend, but you know, I think we have just kind of zeroed in on exactly what our objectives were when we started that thing. And you know, I just had so much fun. I really enjoyed it and walked away feeling really good about it.
Well, let's jump in there just a little bit, because I understand it, like Adair, when he was telling me about it, it was kind of like, you know, you were at least critical to starting it, and it was sort of like something you wanted to participate in. And so that's kind of like, I mean, just you tell me, what was the inspiration for it? And then elaborate a little bit on sort of your vision at the time and now having just completed the fourth iteration of it.
Sure. Yeah. And so I've been involved with French Brittany's and the French Brittany Club for a long time, you know, for about over a decade or so, right in that area. And so through the field trialing, we often try to bring judges in, from Europe, you know, with a bit of a reputation, and our whole field trial program is kind of built on, it's modeled on the FCI trialing program. And so, gosh, it may have been 6 years ago or so, we had a woodcock trial in Georgia, and we brought a Danish judge in, Paul Nielsen, and in conversation it came up that he had won the St. Hubert's Cup, which is the world championship for this particular style of trial, a couple of years prior. And I had heard of the event, but I didn't understand exactly what it was. So I just kind of got to sit around and have him explain it to me. He's a heck of a dog guy, a serious woodcock hunter in Denmark, but big into the trial scene as well. But his favorite thing was the St. Hubert's trial format. And so as he explained it to me, I just thought how neat it was. And I felt like it really filled kind of a vacuum for those that are into dogs and hunt really hard, maybe less so into the games, but even those that may be deeply into the trial games or testing games, to just kind of have a place to go where it's less about competition and more about the ethos of like the conservation ethic and the fellowship. And it kind of, I think it brings the hunting culture and the trialing culture together in a way that doesn't often get to happen. And so usually, I think a lot of times, you know, trialers get a reputation with hunters and people aren't really interested in that. And it maybe just gives them a chance to kind of peek into that world a little bit without feeling the pressure of the competition and less of the politics and more of just the getting together and having fun and dealing with it. And so, yeah, that's how it came about. And then I just, you know, leased a preserve. What was it? 2020, I guess, or 20. No, I can't even remember what year it is. Maybe 20, yeah,
maybe 21. Maybe 21.
Yeah. And I don't think we've actually had four. I think we've only had three.
Okay.
But it's been over a 4-year span. We didn't really skip a year. It just kind of happened that we ended up having the one we would normally have in 24 in early 25. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at least to preserve and had some friends over and we did it. And then it just kind of grew from there. And mm-hmm. Adair came down and I told him, I was like, you know, in a perfect world, I have nothing to do with the execution or the administration right. of this thing because I want to play in it. And I don't want there to be any conflict of interest. I just really, and so we've gotten to that place. We brought the Bird Dog Society in and they handle the heavy lifting as far as that's concerned. And yeah. And it just gives me the opportunity to bring my dogs and have fun competing. And this year I left my last year. I had on a Sunday, I think my dog Pete was placed by Jake Bartels. And so this year I left him at home and brought my lab and she did well. So that's just the fun of it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's again, that's kind of how it was pitched to me. And now having been there and participating in it, I would like my sort of assessment on it would be kind of like you described, you know, if somebody is primarily a hunter and this could, you know, this goes like, you have your first bird dog, you're primarily a hunter. And I talked about this with Jake when I interviewed him before the event, but you know, this event, if you're curious, like what does a structured field trial event look like? You know, where could I go get some experience to run my dog through something? Again, not so much focused on the competition side of things, but just like a structured event where you have, you know, runnings and schedules and just kind of go get some experience with that style of event. That would be perfect. Yeah. And then I think if you are someone that it does a lot of trials and you're very familiar with that type of event, you know, there's nothing here that's going to be earth shattering, but if you just want to go and sort of have fun and sort of just participate, like you said, fellowship and just be a part of the event. I think somebody that probably does a lot of trials has a lot to offer. You know, they could probably be a judge or they could certainly offer advice or insights to some of the people that have less experience. That's my assessment of it. And I think, as I said, when I was at the event, I just felt like, you know, you kind of set the tone with the attitude and how it was approached. And I felt like that was upheld by all the participants. So it was really fun to be a part of it.
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, it's just a manifest deal where, you know, we roll in and we make sure we explain right up front that, hey, this is, you know, this sure we've got a competition going on. And if you know, and it's, there's no shame in wanting to win. But you know, we're all here and we're going to downplay, you know, we kind of made a, conscious decision to like, instead of big trophies and stuff, we give you a piece of paper and a, you know, and a coffee cup is, yeah. you know, if you win, yeah. right? Like it's, you know, there's less fanfare around it. And when I go to, you know, when I go to the field trials, and I'm, you know, I'm trialing my competition dogs, like I show up to win. You know, and I've got friends there and we have a great time, but I've got friends, one friend in particular that we show up to a lot of trials together and we won't speak a word to each other until we're done running. Right. Like there's yeah. certainly a level of competition that, that kind of stifles the fellowship, to some degree. And this game is less of that. And I think that can be kind of off-putting and intimidating maybe to folks that show up to a hunt test or a field trial for the first time. It's so structured, so rigid. And hey, you got to be on the line on time. You got, you know, be here, do this, you know, be at the safety meeting. And really this one is, you know, all those things are a part of it, but they're a much smaller part than the get together, you know, and the just hanging out with like-minded people.
Yeah. All the after hour stuff was, That's fun as well. That's part of it. A lot of camaraderie there.
Yeah, there's a lot of cutting up that goes on at that thing.
this was the second year that it was at H. Cooper Black, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That, I mean, again, for me, just to see the grounds and get, you know, there's get an idea of like what the landscape looks like from a hunting perspective and running dogs, and, you know, field trial grounds are obviously sort of their own deal, but just to get out and walk through some of that stuff, was a lot of fun. What do you know? Like, I guess, how did you guys decide on that location, and tell the listeners a little bit about it? 'Cause it's got some history, I think.
Yeah. I really, Cooper Black is, it's one of the premier testing and trialing venues in, especially in the Carolinas, in North Carolina that are publicly owned, especially. So in North Carolina, you have the Hoffman Field Trial Grounds, which I believe are the Robert J. Gordon Field Trial Grounds. And that's primarily a horseback venue, with large courses. They run all age stakes on that. They don't really, I don't think it's utilized at all by the retriever people. There's some walking shooting dog trials that are held there. I think the U.S. Complete Championship are held there. But when you go there, it's very similar in regards to kind of cover and terrain. They're both in what we would consider the Sandhills region.
Okay.
But Hoffman is really an extremely well-groomed, maintained. It's almost like a golf course if you were to see an aerial for a horseback field trial venue. And that's, I want to say that one came along in like the late 50s, early 60s. There were in that region, in this area, there were plenty of places where field trials were held prior to this. But as far as the state is concerned and got involved, I think Hoffman was probably earlier than Cooper Black. I want to say Cooper Black came along in the 70s or 80s. But the same kind of deal, that the region, the Sandhills, has, you know, probably been utilized for field trials since the 19th century. In this area in particular, all the way down the Piedmont in North Carolina, and South Carolina, was a major destination for kind of Northerners to come down and recreate on quail. So, when people think of that, they often think of that Southwest Georgia region and the plantation country.
Mm-hmm.
That was around at that time as well. But this was kind of a stop on the way to that. This never really had the plantation culture, but the culture here was lease up a bunch of farmland out of season, out of the growing season and out of the harvest season, and come down here, and they would build lodges everywhere. You know, the kind of robber barons of that era. And just have kind of run of the place as much as they wanted, because every farmer was happy to just lease off whatever farmland they had. And they would even, kind of leave edge cover and stuff. But this was a major destination for that. And then the Sandhills in and of itself was, a premier area for quail hunting at the time. And so from a quail hunting and trialing perspective, it's a great area. And I didn't really contrast H. Cooper Black, but what I love about Cooper Black, we started using it, or the first time I was introduced to it, was at a French Brittany National. The Carolinas Club hosted the national field trial for the French Brittanies, probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I had been to Hoffman, but I had never been to Cooper Black. And so their kind of field trial grounds, whether it be horseback or walking trials for pointing dogs, are kind of less, I don't want to say they're not as well maintained, but they're not groomed in the real kind of clean way that Hoffman is. And for the kind of foot trial, I liked it more. It was just, there was, it wasn't quite as homogeneous in terms of cover. And so you had drains and privet and things like that, and things you would see in maybe a more kind of natural hunting environment in this state. So I think it's just a perfect place if you're going to throw a gun over your shoulder, walk a dog out. Obviously, we don't have a wild bird population down there to support trialing, but for a planted bird trial, you definitely get the feel that you're hunting in the region the way you would be.
That was going to be my next question. The course that I was a judge on the second day, 118 or whatever, the one that goes through the timber, it's kind of like thin timber, you know, it's like thin timber, but then there's grass and stuff. Like, if you were out hunting wild quail, could you be hunting in places like that? Or is that not quite like a wild setting?
Yeah. I mean, if you had a large contiguous tract like that, there's not many of those left in the area.
Yeah.
But you certainly could be that. To me, that's a little more reminiscent of what you might still today find in Southwest Georgia plantation country. Mm-hmm. And that's that low basal area, longleaf pine, with native grasses coming up in between. We would call that a pine plantation or a pine savanna. And it's, you know, down here, I would say in the sand hills, yes. I think that's been a kind of a very large, long lasting, contiguous, longleaf, giant habitat area.
Yeah.
And so you would find those big savannas in areas like that. Where I come from, it's a little more hardwood. And then most of the Piedmont, I would say, would be a mix of hardwood and pine, and less of those huge swaths of longleaf that you would find in that area. So for us, yes, we're familiar with that kind of landscape for hunting on, and it makes a perfect trialing venue. But I would say for probably most of the Carolinas, quail hunting was really more of a mosaic of 40 acre farms with, you know, dirty ag practices, and it was, you know, probably less romantic here than it would be down there. But that being said, you know, still really, really good kind of quail habitat. So it's fun to visit those areas for me, but, I don't think my grandpa or great uncles or anything were usually hunting in areas like that. They were usually kicking around the ditches and fence lines somewhere.
Yeah. You could certainly see why that would be, you know, sort of the romantic version of, you know, you've got the big towering pines overhead and it's like you're in cover, but it's like, you know, pretty easy to stroll through there, and it's beautiful and it's scenic, and heck, you got birds in there. I mean, you could see the dog run, like it's awesome. But yeah, I was curious how sort of authentic that was. The last 2 years I've been down there driving, like, it's just so funny for me. Like, I leave, you know, I drive out of Minnesota, so I leave the forest up the North Woods and drive through the Midwest, you know, prairies, and not so much prairies, but like agriculture and open areas. And then I get down there and like you get back into the trees. And specifically, I drove quite a bit through Georgia last year. And then when I was driving around Cooper Black, just to see the active forestry, I mean, that just like, it totally piques my curiosity, because it's I don't know. I guess I'm just like, I have such limited time down there, but I see, you know, the logging operations and the forestry, and it gets the wheels turning in my mind. I was on my way home, I was driving, I was kind of like thinking and taking notes on, I sort of wanted to interview somebody, whether it be it a forester or like a quail biologist or somebody that has a real good grasp on the ecosystem down there. Again, just sort of my own curiosity. So if anybody out there listening has a suggestion, let me know, or if you do, Grayson, but.
I'll say this. I mean, we do have a really active timber industry, especially when you get south and east of where I am, and into that kind of pinier area. But for the longleaf habitat, that's the native pine. Yeah. And it doesn't lend itself to the timber industry in terms of plantation. Okay. It doesn't. So where you're seeing most of those cuts would be stands of loblolly, we would call loblolly. And that's what you're, you know, what you're going and buying your 2x4s of, you know, from Lowe's. And, but that said, every one of those cutovers you drove by, you know, depending on its maturity, is likely holding birds. They're just really hard to hunt in that stuff. And most of that's going to be private, but even where it's public, that's the kind of area you would not be surprised at all to find a covey of quail, but you're going to come out bleeding. Your dog's probably not going to want to challenge the cover. It's just choked out with blackberry and multiflora or whatever other gnarly thing is going to be in there. And that's what you're going to be wading through to get to those birds. So.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did see, you know, some varying age stands, some real young stuff that actually had cover, but then there were some recent cuts too, where you know, it's like moonscape. I mean, they take it down to nothing. Like there was nothing there. You can just see everything. So, I mean, how long does that, if you go a year, will that, the ones that are just totally clear, are those, they got grass coming up and stuff?
Yeah. They'll come in grass, and usually they'll come back and be replanted.
Right.
And you know, the problem with those things, and it really those first couple of years, once the grasses are in, the clump grasses are in, if you've got the birds, that's the time to access them. You know, I'd say once you get to about year three, you're going to recognize the pines really well. And by the time you're in year three and year four is when, you know, when it gets hard to hunt. And then, you know, I'd say by year seven, you're getting into a more homogeneous overhead pine stand. But you know, those things can be, they can be productive, and there can be areas to get into them. And a lot of times, especially when the, you know, when the pines get kind of semi-mature and the gums come in, the woodcock really like them if they're adjacent to, you know, any kind of swampy riparian areas too. So it's just, you know, they're productive spots. And if you learn how to hunt them right, you can have a lot of fun in them, but you can also get yourself in a pickle and have a bad day real fast. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, awesome, man. Well, let's I want to segue a little bit, and I mean, we're half hour into this, but for those that may not know you, Grayson, give us a quick sort of rundown on your background and like what led you to start Lost Highway Kennels.
Sure. So I have been either a hobbyist or professional dog trainer, or a mix of the two, for going on, gosh, like 26 years now. And I started, when I was in the service with a Malinois puppy, and I played in the protection sports and worked around working dogs for quite a while. And, you know, in between other attempts at more serious professions, or what other people, my parents namely, thought were more serious professions in college, I would train pet dogs. I, you know, was in college, was training pet dog classes in the park, or, you know, working for various other pet dog trainers in the region. And in the, you know, in the late aughts, in the 2010, 2011 timeframe, I went to work, for a DOD contractor training bomb dogs on a Marine Corps contract. And so that was, we utilized labs in that program primarily, and kind of used them as if they were hunt test dogs or field trial dogs. But instead of going out and picking up a duck, they would go in search of bombs and indicate when they found them. But we handled them like a duck dog, essentially. And so I had a lot of exposure to some really high level trainers there, and kind of made, you know, I was getting into my early middle age at that time, and recognizing that I probably didn't have a whole lot of time to focus on other things in my life, you know, and I had made a living at dog training for long enough that it was time, when those contracts wound down and the war wound down, I just hung a shingle. And, you know, it's morphed over time, but where I am today is, kind of full service gun dog, retriever, spaniels, pointers. I think most of my work is in pointing breeds, but it's a bit of a hybrid pet obedience, gun dog program. And so I call it companion gun dog, the companion gun dog program, and the dogs are boarded in the home and going through pet obedience stuff, and at the same time getting their basic, you know, basic bird dog and gun dog exposure to, and hopefully leave here ready to hunt. And if they come back, we can maybe do a more advanced type program at some point.
Yeah.
But that's long, I guess, long story short there.
Yeah. I love it. I was curious about it. Where did the Lost Highway Kennels come from?
So that's the name of a Hank Williams song. And
okay.
When I was working for the bomb dog outfit, I was spending a lot of time, deploying with the Marines. So I was in Afghanistan, two times on that program. And just one of those times, you know, when you were over there, it would get, you were either extremely busy or had nothing to do. And right. Oftentimes you had nothing to do for a long, like maybe a week on, you know, a week long visit to a forward operating base somewhere. and your guys weren't there, nobody was there, and you were in, you know, what they would call a transient hooch, like a just bunch of sandbags built up by yourself. So I spent a lot of time listening to music and thinking about what I wanted to do with myself when it was all over. And I always liked that song, and I felt like it kind of was a bit reminiscent of my own life. So that's where we came up with the name.
Love it. All right. Every trainer kind of has their own style, right? How would you describe your approach to training dogs and maybe what makes it unique or different?
Boy, that's a big, broad question. You know what? I think something that is very important to me is kind of a grounding in the principles of dog training and the principles of behavior. So I have my own podcast where I kind of spew a bunch of $2 words, but it's less about the practical application of the training and more about how I organize it in my head and the way I try to articulate it to others. And so in terms of the methods I employ, it's much less important to me than kind of where that fits in those basic systems of behaviorism. And so I tend to use a lot of different methods, depending on the dog I have and what the objectives are. But the most important thing to me is I kind of know where I stand in the moment, you know, based on my own beliefs around those principles. And so, I do the traditional thing. I think the most important thing is that you get up every day and you give it an honest effort, you know, and I think, you know, that makes me a lot more of a dog trainer than all of the theory and the knowledge and stuff. But you get up, you do the thing you need to do every day. You do it consistently over a long period of time. And before you know it, new training has occurred.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, but it could be, you know, anything from whether it's clickers and treats or a force fetch and e-collar, I employ all that stuff. And, you know, when it comes to bird dogs, I think nature is, you know, what we need to lean on to let our bird dogs become bird dogs. And so I try my best to just facilitate their interactions with birds and stay out of the way and then put the handle on them where it's needed. And, you know, when it comes to the more advanced stuff, whether it be NAVDA type, you know, technical retrieving work or retrievers and their technical retrieving work, then that's a little more engaged. But for bird dogs, I really like to just let them be dogs and let them learn what it means to be a bird dog on their own as much as I can. Mm-hmm. It's tougher for us since we don't, yep. You know, I wish I could spend as much time in a, you know, high density, high volume area as, you
with,
know,
like with you wild got, birds.
Yeah. With wild yeah. birds. So much of what I do is really spent trying to mimic what I would think of, you know, wild bird interactions would be like yep. to the best of our ability. But you know, at the end of the day, you're limited by your own imagination to some degree, but then just the fact that wild birds are always gonna be better for the dog than pin raised birds, but you do what you can.
Yeah. Focusing on the process, right? That's sure. That's where like my mind goes to that, because like you said, it's easy for like a guy like me, I can come up with the end result, like, oh geez, I love my dog to do this, but to try to understand the nuances and what is the process to get to that end result? You know, that's where, that's where you step in. And I feel like obviously are helping your customers, clients, that sort of thing. But it's like a lot of things in life, you know, you do simple processes consistently and they lead to the results more so than, you know, one big thing you're going to do on one day. Like, so separating those two ideas.
Well, and I'm sure, and you know, and I've listened, honestly, it's cool to be on this podcast. I don't listen to a lot of industry podcasts on a regular basis. But there's a few that I've always listened to when I saw something interesting come across. And long before your Birdshot, I was listening. So, you know, and to various ones. And so I feel like I'm kind of familiar with your thought process on bird dogs and that, you know, and having access to a lot of wild birds. And so for me, the process is, hey, let's develop a relationship with your dog. Let's be safe about how we introduce the gun. Let's have a baseline compliance and obedience to the point where I can get you home when I need you home, and I can kind of keep you safe in the field. And then after that, you know, for me down here, we'll get the birds in front of the dogs to the point where they're excited to go hunt them. We'll do our best to kind of draw out what, you know, Mother Nature's given the dog in regards to being a little staunch. And then I encourage all of my clients as much as possible to just go travel and hunt, or hunt locally, do whatever you got to do.
What you can do, yeah.
Yeah, while you have the bird season, you know, be in wild birds. Even I would rather you go walk, you know, 40 hours for one grouse contact in the mountains than to go to the preserve and flood your dog with a bunch of messy, bad birds, you know. So
Yeah, there is a difference. I mean, especially being fresh off of the planted bird trial that
absolutely.
We did.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You see the kind of, and like, again, exposure to certain things, like there, you sure. can see how that's, you know, some dogs, they see a chucker pop up and start walking around in front of them, and some are steady and some go right after it. And
yep,
it's easy to see how that could get your dog into trouble if it was not doing the right thing and got exposed to that over and over and over again.
Yes.
Wild bird's not going to tolerate that, obviously, but
yeah,
that's, you got to do what you got to do. Like you said, okay. So client comes to you, how do you think about, like, you know, when you're assessing, like, how much is assessing, okay, the handler and where this person is at versus, you know, then we eventually get to the dog and where the dog's at. I imagine there's a healthy dose of both.
Well, and I think, to be fair, I think that's for all trainers. You know, we mm-hmm. have to deal with that. You know, for me in particular, though, I've kind of built my business around developing relationships with the clients. And so my hope is, you know, I don't take dogs month by month for long periods of time. I want to keep your dog just long enough to have a good, solid obedience foundation in the house and around, you know, and the general compliance, like we talked about, long enough to get more than a bird intro, but to have you have a dog that really wants to go out and hunt, and can be shot over safely. And then again, what kind of draw out as much as possible in that short time period as Mother Nature's given the dog. And then I want you to go hunt. And then I want us to stay in touch, hopefully for the next 10, 12 years, you mm-hmm. know, over the course of the life of that dog. And I've got, you know, and some, you know, it's some people are going to come and you may never hear from them again, but I've got many, many clients, you know, that started with me 6, 7, 8 years ago when I first stood this thing up, and, you know, now are on their second, third dog. Some of them are deep into whatever testing or trialing venue. Some of them are just, you know, serious bird hunters now, but many of them were just getting their feet wet at the time. And so I really enjoy that, those kind of outcomes, you know, and especially the process and watching those people learn. And a lot of it is just doing my best to guide them. And again, just like the dogs, kind of stay out of their way and let them learn on their own and try to let, you know, as opposed to, you know, imprinting my affect on them to whatever degree it may be necessary.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I did get a, you know, I spoke with a lot of people at the event that were obviously clients of yours. You know, it's not a surprise there. Maybe all but that sentiment was evident. You know, they were all sort of very enthusiastic, and I don't know, they spoke highly of you and working with you and the dogs, and obviously they're seeing their dogs do well. So it's fun. Maybe all the people that don't like you weren't at the event, but
I'm sure there's plenty. All right. But it's, I'm just lucky to, you know, that to have kind of been able to blunder my way through this thing and find that, you know, what works for me. And it's, you know, I'll never be great at being a businessman. I'll never have a big operation or scale this thing. I'm, you know, I'm lucky that I kind of operate my business off of it's really a private hunting preserve that I manage for to some degree a benefactor. I pay kind of a nominal lease and get to run my business here. I couldn't do it otherwise the way I do, you know,
and the space. Yeah.
Yeah. And it gives me the opportunity to do that, to take my time with the people, even though again, the programs are relatively short. The idea is, you know, you come and once the dog leaves, you're not necessarily leaving the sphere of influence. You're always here and I'm always here to help. And, you know, and hopefully we can go hunt together during the season, you know, when your dog leaves. So,
yeah. I mean, you're, again, focus on relationship. It's such a small world, you know, this,
yeah,
like we're in a small world.
Very. And
even just like Kristen, she had a little Brittany, and I was on your website and I saw you've worked with Rob Moore, which I didn't know. Rob Moore. He's a customer of the Up and Gun Company. We engraved his dog on the gun, and I was talking to Kristen and that her dog's out of Lincoln. If I'm remembering everything correctly. And
it's a tiny world, man.
Yeah.
And Rob, by the way, is a, you know, really blossomed into a great writer, but you talk about a guy who, you know, hopefully not embarrass Rob, but to, you know, that went from being a, you know, casually finding his way into this world to now he's living in Maine. He's a certified Maine guide. You know, he's got a second dog. He's got, you know, I mean, he lives the lifestyle hard now, you know, and it wasn't a flash in the pan deal, but it took a long time to get there. But he is, you know, there's a lot of the, you know, the, some people live that way with golf or racing cars or whatever, you know, and this is our little, not more than a hobby, but certainly a community.
Yes. Yep. I would agree. It's been a while since I've connected with Rob, but the passion was evident. You know, I could tell just in conversations with him, sort of how he was thinking about the dogs and the birds and the shotguns. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's really is. It's all encompassing, and yeah, it is a small world. So it's always cool to meet new folks in it. But
for sure.
Is there a common, like when people are approaching you, they need help. Do you have is it kind of all across the board? Like somebody, one person needs force fetch, somebody else needs basic obedience and bird dog intro. Is there a more common client that you work with?
Yeah, I think I would say probably most common are just relatively novice folks. I do have quite a few people that, my board and train program is really set up at least for, if it's not a novice handler, for a young dog to get started. And again, they can come back and work on more advanced things later, but that kind of intro is built that way. And so I would say the majority of my clients are relatively novice. They're finding their way into this community and world we were discussing. But in terms of the specifics, I think much of what I've kind of figured out my job is to kind of help people navigate their own desires. Like, what is it they want? Because, you know, there's so much minutia in what is required to, you know, make a dog steady a wing shot and fall, or to have a great duck search, or to be a, you know, a senior or master level retriever, even a good spaniel or whatever. It's, you know, people come in with this idea in their mind about what they think the finished product looks like. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes on the way to that objective, they realize that's not what they really wanted out of the experience in the first place. And so what I really feel like a lot of my job is kind of helping people figure out what it is they want. Because if what you want to go do is shoot, you know, shoot birds in other states and enjoy the hunting aspect, I wouldn't say it's wasted time to go preparing for trials and tests, but they're not, those two objectives don't always jive with each other.
Yeah. The ROI, you know, on your time becomes
exactly
a factor.
Yeah. And I mean, to me at the end of the day, I love to trial and I love to test, but I love to hunt more, you know? And so, but it's a lot of effort for me to keep my dogs, you know, tidy through the hunting season. And oftentimes like this time of year, they're just not, you know? And so, you know, it's just stuff to think about for folks.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense because, again, as I've said many, many times over the years, like I'm not that far removed from, you know, approaching my first bird dog. And I remember, like, you know, you read the books and I'm envisioning like way more structured training and drills and all kinds, just thinking like, oh, well, I've got to do this to have a hunting dog. Yeah. And again, just through my own experience and obviously working and talking with a lot of people that have a lot more experience than I have learned, my path has sort of shifted and
sure.
I feel like I'm steering it a lot more now than I was, which makes sense. But I didn't really know where I was headed, but now I have a pretty clear idea of what I want to do with my dogs, where I want to be with them. There's things I still would like to do and accomplish and do more. I mean, I think that's healthy. We always want to improve.
Sure.
But just, and one of the things that I, of course, benefit from is access to wild birds. So that helps me and my dogs a lot. And it maybe lessens some of the things that we need to do in some areas, but then there's other areas where I could improve and do stuff better. But yeah, that just resonates with me. You just don't really know where you're headed until you kind of have an idea.
I think that's it. And it's, you know, I got one particular client this year, his name's Brian, and you know, he came, and this, I would say this is not an uncommon story for me, but he kind of showed up, and I knew he's an intense dude that whatever he's going to do, he wants to do it the best and to the max. And he has a very talented young short hair. And he shows up, and you know, and it's like trying to get him to just slow it down a little bit. You know, it's the first and second year dog, and he's one that broke out, and he's thinking of challenging UT, and he's got all these things in his mind. And then early season, he went with our buddy Stump, met him in Michigan, and went for his first like grouse hunt, and his dog's knocking birds every, he's embarrassed. The dog's bumping birds, and everybody's explaining to him like, hey man, you know, all the training in the world don't make a grouse dog.
Yeah, dude.
You know, and then day three, day four, the dog starts handling them. And then this season, like the guy, I don't know if he still has a job or not, you know, but he ended up in like North Dakota, Kansas, you know, wherever. And he has just, and he's killing, he's finding wild quail in North Carolina. I mean, he is obsessed, you know, and he just completely off the deep end with the wild bird stuff. And I finally getting to the, you know, to that place where he's recognizing like the experience is much less about check cords and launchers and, you know, getting everything perfect and more about being out there and doing it for real, you know.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that we were driving around planting birds the first morning, we got to talking about, well, we were looking at maps and stuff or talking about maps, and you had told me about one of the things that you'll do, like a service you offer that you'll do with people is kind of, you explain it on your website a little bit. It's not so much a guided hunt of sorts, but it's more of like a collaborative learn to hunt thing. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I've woodcock, you know, they're what we have as far as a huntable species is concerned. But I think most people that, you know, I understand why if I lived in a place with a heavy population of grouse, maybe I would be a little less enthusiastic about my woodcock hunting, or if we still had the kind of quail of the days of yore here. But for me, they're not only the thing I get to hunt the most, but something I tend to, you know, have obsessed on long enough that that they're just a very special bird to me. And I started out probably 10 years ago. I offered a couple of guided trips, and it always left me feeling just a little icky because I was guiding on public land, which is legal.
Yeah.
Where we are. But you know, I was kind of spot burning, and not just, there are other people that will do it. It's not passing judgment at all. But for me, I just didn't really enjoy it. But I kept finding myself like telling my clients like, hey man, you need to hunt wild birds. And they're like, I just don't know where to start. Or, right. Hey, I went 15 times last year and never moved a bird. You know, and so it just got me thinking like, okay, well, I'd take one or two of my clients, but I said, like, I'm not going to take you back to birds. And it's not just for my personal, what I enjoy the most in hunting woodcock in this area is finding new birds and finding new places. And that's the experience I'm after. And I think most people, when they get kind of pat, you know, there's phases to our hunting careers where, you know, when I was a kid and I was got one of my first couple of duck hunts, you could not restrain me. Like all I wanted to do was kill birds, you know, and even as I was finding out more about finding wild birds with the dogs, I was kind of dealing with that myself. Like, I just want to go. It wasn't successful if I didn't put three birds in the bag every time I went, you know, and I think that's a story as old as time for most all hunters, as you kind of mature into caring less about that, more about the experience, understanding that the ROI as far as meat's concerned, woodcock hunting is completely negligible.
Yep.
You know? And so, Yeah. So what it ended up becoming is just a service that I was offering to my clients at first, which was, let's get together. Let me show you how to map scout, how I look at a map, how I look at the terrain, how I think about, and, you know, I'm not an ecologist or a biologist. I really, everything I'm passing in terms of my general thoughts on the woodcock migration are just based on what I've read from other people and my own intuition. Right. And so we get on OnX together. We'll do a little screen share scenario, talk about the general woodcock migration, and then kind of isolate it, go from a macro terrain to a micro terrain kind of a process. And then at the end, I'm going to say, like, okay, I want you to pick a piece of public that you think after that should hold birds. And we'll go out, and sometimes we get skunked. You know, most times this year, for sure, we found birds. We only got skunked a couple of times. But even if that's the case, they've been through the process at this point, and yeah, it's hunting, you know, and I want them to understand that we're not going, you're going to find them, and you're going to go to places that, you know, you can visit over and over again, and the birds will be there until you finally have decided to made them decide to leave, you know, and, which happens on occasion, but, finding the real reward and kind of understanding, the habitat and your own. And for me, it's like, what a great way to connect with your own home. Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of us feel that way, that hunt close to home is like, I learned something new about my own little geographic region every year. I feel more connected to it every year. And yeah, I mean, you spend a lot of time studying your home range.
Yeah. Yeah. That is certainly where I get much of my enjoyment, where I'm at right now. You know, will it be that way 25 years from now? I hope so, because it's kind of like the most fun, I feel like, to learn about your areas. You know, again, like you said, from a micro, like from an actual cover, like this is one of my favorite covers and here's why, and then this is my favorite region, and you know, 10 miles this way is maybe looks a little bit different, 10 miles the other way is different, and I just really get a lot of enjoyment trying to understand what makes them different and why are birds here versus there. And
I mean, it crosses so many things. You got the habitat, you've got the kind of natural, not just the natural beauty, but maybe the natural history of the area that gets wrapped into that. Mm-hmm. So we're moving from different soil types to different forest types and cover types and all those things. And then you get the cultural history that comes along with it. You start finding little artifacts every time you go out, you know, you're always finding some old home place, you know, or, you know, for us, we live in the area that Daniel Boone kind of grew up in and left, you know, and so there's traces of that time period all over the place. And so it kind of becomes like a cultural and eco tour to some degree when I take people out too. And it really, since I've started thinking that way, I think my appreciation for the places I visit now to hunt has grown that much more, because it's less about just finding the birds and more about appreciating, you know, when you're in New England or that area and they're in the stone walls and it's Corey Ford and Tap Tapley and all that stuff, or the upper Midwest has, you know, maybe less of the cultural stuff, even though there's a lot of it, but the natural beauty and the natural history. So forward every time you're out in that area. So yeah, that's, to me, is like, that's the experience, you know, and the birds become kind of secondary to it.
The old stone wall, old apple orchard is kind of burned in my brain. You know, it's been written about so many times. It's on my bucket list. I've never experienced that. And that is one that, again, just due to the reading and stuff over the years, I would love to experience that at some point.
Yeah. And I really, visiting our mutual friend, Bob,
you guys were talking about that.
Yeah. And you know, the bird numbers probably where he is are not near what they could be even in that region, but when you're out there, I mean, it's absolutely, you feel like you're walking back into one of those old, you know, old upland books.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, so I mean, you travel around and I know you've been up to the Great Lakes and grouse hunt. Do you have is there a favorite hunt, or is it kind of just, I mean, you kind of hit on a lot of it, like it's not so much about just going and finding a specific bird in a specific place, but you kind of appreciate it all, and obviously you appreciate the dog work.
Oh, 100%. You know, I think I love finding woodcock. I love thinking about them. I've hunted them in Louisiana and, you know, New York and the upper Midwest. And of course, down here in the Southeast. And And it's always fun when you get into the areas where their range overlaps with grouse. But, you know, I've also been lucky enough to kind of go to, you know, all the prairie or many of the prairie states and hunt what they have to offer in Oklahoma and Texas for quail. I mean, it's just, you know, it's never not satisfying, you know. So it's tough to say what would be a favorite, but yeah. I guess probably at the end of the day, like my home range and my woodcock, yeah. You know.
I can appreciate that. Have you ever had a dog completely defy your expectations for better or for worse?
I've had that many times. And I would say, you know, and I would say a lot of, I don't know if this is my reputation. I would hope it would be, is to be maybe the guy that takes on dogs others wouldn't, or, you know, and I'll often get maybe the Labradoodle or the kind of really spooky dog that was kind of turned over by a different trainer. And it's not, again, it's not passing judgment on another trainer for that. Cause I understand why they would do it, but going into it with the client, that's a big part of it, is like, hey, you know, we got the deck stacked against us, but if we can, you know, to see one turn the corner, to me, I would so much prefer to see a dog that by all accounts shouldn't do it. Than to go win any number of field trials with a dog that's, you know, perfect out the box and the genes all stacked up just perfectly and, you know, and everything happens, you know, easy. So, you know, I just sent one home that was a gun shy rehab that we had never tried to, we didn't know it would be gun shy, but we knew it would be gun shy type of dog, just a very kind of spooky, unstable, very sensitive dog right off the bat. And, you know, it just, the gun intro turned into a months long process and, you know, the guy was ready to quit. And I just, you know, I just said, man, I just had an intuitive little thing that was telling me, don't quit on him yet. Just let's see if the light comes on. And, you know, he went home an absolute bird dog, you know, a couple of weeks ago. So those are my favorites. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it'd be hard to pinpoint one.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then every once, you know, and at the end of the day, every once in a while you try your hardest and it's not in the cards, you know, but as long as you gave it the old college try, I think you can, you know, feel pretty good about it.
Is there a common trait amongst like great hunting dogs that you feel like they all kind of have?
To me, it's like just a general confidence, you know, I mean, you're going to find holes in everything, you know, you might have your dog with the prettiest ground coverage. It looks great on planted birds. And then 3 years after hunting the wheels off the dog for wild birds, you just recognize it's not a bird finder. You know, those are out there, you know, that just have everything in the world except the ability to find birds, you know, where others maybe, you know, and you know it, like you'd run that dog and then you pull another dog out behind them and they're going to go find birds that dog just missed, you know? And, but I would say, you know, there's all sorts of little traits that will, you know, as a collective make it great. But for me, the thing that sticks out the most when I first see a dog is, you know, they don't have to come out, you know, head and tail high and great body carriage and present themselves as the most confident dog in the world. But I want to see them be exposed to new things. And if they're worried about them or they're the least bit trepidatious, how quickly do they recover? You know, and so I don't necessarily need you to tackle everything in the world with exuberance and confidence, but I want to see you become comfortable in your own skin quickly in new, across all sorts of new environments.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I usually with those kind of dogs, they can move at a steady pace through training.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, a dog that has confidence and finds birds, you know, that's going to make up for a lot of deficiencies if it had any.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, it's always nice if they like to point, you know, a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that, too.
Yeah, depending on the breed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because we got a lad that I would rather not point as hard as she does.
Is there a training myth that you wish would go away?
Oh, man. Maybe
that you commonly hear.
I don't get as hung up on it. I always kind of enjoy some of the things. And I think all of them You know, I'm trying to think of one right now. I mean, I always get a little miffed. Yeah, but this isn't really in our world near as much as it is the pet industry, you know, at the hardline, purely positive crowd kind of annoys me to a degree because I don't think they're doing the dogs as many favors as they think they're doing. And so I always worry about that kind of edging its way into this side. I think because our dogs are performance oriented, that's not as likely, you know, but I defy most of the wives' tales. You know, I play tug with all my dogs. I do all that kind of stuff. And, but again, I think most of those things are rooted in some bit of good old fashioned sense for one reason or another. And, you know, I try not to be too judgmental when it comes to those things. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, I'm going to defy all of them personally and kind of, you know, scoff a little bit, but at the, you know, nothing really sticks in my craw too bad about it.
Yeah. Let's see here. What else do I got for you? Okay. If someone is getting their first bird dog, what is one thing they should absolutely do and one thing they should definitely avoid, if you can think of anything?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, okay, you're going to get your first bird dog. I would say, you know, time permitting, you just get to know, you know, get into the local scene a little bit and meet the dogs and meet what you like. You know, and even if you have a notion, I think we all have a lot of preconceived notions. I can't ever settle on what it is I like. So like right now I've got, you know, a couple of French Brittany's, I got a Springer and a Lab, and I'm into all of it. Like I just can't ever from one day to the next, what's my favorite, you know? And so I would say just get as familiar as possible with it. And I've had some clients that did that, that like spent a year when they knew they were considering it, you know, getting to know various breeds, getting to know various breeders and trainers and things like that. And I think that's always a good idea. It doesn't guarantee success. Nothing does. I mean, there's always going to be a little bit of luck of the draw. You can get the best bred litter in the world and you may end up with a bit of a dud to some degree. So you just, you know, go in with the understanding that that's the case.
Yeah.
And always just kind of have a little humility in terms of what you know, because every great trainer I know learns to kind of maybe be humble, or they expect to be humbled, you know, at some point. And so you see a lot of folks get into it early and, you know, they maybe gain a little more confidence than they should sometimes. So just humility and patience and really work hard at trying to find what it is you want and learning what it is you want. And then remind me of what was the contrast to that?
Just if there was anything they should definitely avoid.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say like, be careful being marketed to, right? Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's something I see out here a lot. And the bird dog breeds aren't quite as bad about it. I'm probably in one of the worst bird dog breeds for that. The French Brittany, you know, I mean, like there are a lot of folks that are disappointed when they get a French Brittany that is an absolute hammer, you know, and is just, you know, hard and fast and loves to go and find birds. And they're expecting this kind of plotty little, you know, a lot of folks in their mind's eye somehow expect a French Brittany to be a gun range type of dog. And sometimes you get something like that, but that's nobody's aiming for that type of dog in their breeding program, right? It's a bird dog at the end of the day. It's going to quest. We hope they're affectionate. We hope they're biddable and trainable and tractable and all those things, but nobody in that's actually breeding those dogs hopes that they're not out there really looking for birds hard, you know? And so when you're looking for your specific breeds, there's a lot of breeds, whether it be the retriever breeds, you're going to, these come from this specific country and they're much more calm than other dogs. Sometimes that's the case. Those are generalities. Oftentimes those dogs are not calmer than their American counterpart oftentimes, you know? And so, get it, because there's nothing wrong with falling in love with the idea of the dog. But go in with your eyes open and recognize that you're better off knowing, getting a dog, you know, the parents, you're familiar with the breeder. I would rather have any breed where I kind of knew the background of the dog, And I kind of knew what I was expecting than to buy anything sight unseen because I'm in love with the idea of that particular breed.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense to me. I mean, there's so many different breeds, right? And then everybody, you know, hunting is not the same for one person to the next. So it's, but you kind of like broad strokes get painted because at some point you just kind of have to paint them to sort of like, okay, why this versus that? So it's just like something we do, but I think like to your point, you don't really know what you got until you got it. So it's more like you said, going with your eyes open. And I think I'm speaking from my experience here. The value really came for me when I just got more experience around dogs and learned how to read a dog more so than, you know, a snippet in a magazine on why I want this breed or that breed. You just can't replicate hands-on real world experience.
No. And I mean, and I always, you know, I'm always conflicted when I'm trying to explain this to people because you should get the thing you want. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you want a setter, you're probably not going to be satisfied with a griff, you know, but knowing that when you go into it, this is what I'm looking for.
Yep.
Now be careful being marketed to within that specific niche. Now go visit the setter kennels, go find the dogs you like, you know, and, you know, but if it's a griff you want, the same kind of deal, you know, recognize like, hey, if you don't want one that's really poofy and fluffy and going to get full of cockle burrs, you need to go find the lines that don't have that going on, you know?
Yeah, I love it. Well, at this point, is it safe to say there will be another iteration of the St. Hubert's trial?
I, you know, as long as I'm around, we'll do it as to the best, you know, we'll make them happen. I'm just hoping I don't have to be the one making those decisions. Right.
Yep,
but I feel like, all the feedback I got from those involved, I think they're pretty happy with it and happy about it. I think, Nick did such an amazing job, like bringing in, you know, corporate partners and things like that. But I think it was good for that entire crowd. And so I think they're happy and they'll probably want to continue to support. And then of course, I think Bird Dog Society, it's a good event for them, you know, I like the fact that they're kind of goal oriented and they work hard to do the things that are within their mission set, but they're not an enormous conservation organization that this thing's a little drop in the bucket to. So it's really to me kind of been, something that they can really build, you know, as a central event for them. So fingers crossed. I mean, you never know, but I feel like I'm pretty confident it's going to keep moving on in the way it's going.
Yeah. We don't obviously have any specifics or details, but that was the sentiment I got. And it sounds like there's discussions will take place about sort of when and where and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But for anybody that has piqued their interest about it, be on the lookout for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that we ever went back. And so I guess just quickly, I could say like what it is, it is a field trial, but the rule set is, there's shot game on the course. So it has to be pen raised birds.
Yeah.
We use chucker, and it's you and your dog and your shotgun and your judge, you know, you're walking out there in 20 minute runs and it's not a speed game. It's not a timed event. It's the idea, you know, there is a rule set, but at the end of the day, what I hope, and I think every judge should know coming in and has known to this point, is you're going to place the dog that you would most like to go and join on a field with their handler, you know? And so, but yeah, that's the idea from a 30,000 foot view, I guess.
Yeah. And I would add it like very approachable from the participant's perspective to, again, not so structured that you have to like know exactly what it is you're out there. It's just like, go do what you would do if you were out.
Yeah.
That's like the, you know, when Nick Adair like really boiled it down, he's like, you know, the participant is going out there. They've got a blank course. They know their birds planted out there, but you don't know where, that kind of thing. It's just like, go approach it how you would if you were out running your dog, basically.
Yeah. You just go hunting. And there is, I mean, there's the hunting class, which is a little more casual.
Yes.
And there is a trialer's class.
Yeah.
If you are really competitive and you want to come out with your broke dog and be held to a higher standard, you know, the options exist on both ends. But yeah, I mean, I love it. It's my favorite game that I play, you know, outside of the wild stuff. Yeah. You know, if we get the opportunity to do a Woodcock trial here and there down here, I get excited. I've always wanted to come run cover dog trials up north, but that's a big hill to climb if you're not in, you know, yeah. don't have the ability to spend as much time in the grouse woods as those guys.
Yeah. So, if you're going hunting, do you have a favorite shotgun that you take every time? Do you have a regular rotation?
Yeah, I really don't. It's really funny. It was my me gift to myself when I came back from my last deployment to Afghanistan. I bought a 1921 LC Smith field grade.
I think I saw a picture of that on your website.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been, you know, that's the gun that I'm most likely to carry if I'm out for a bird hunt. But I just have a cheap Turkish semi-auto that I end up hunting with just as much 12 gauge, but it's like, if I'm going to go duck hunting and stomp around the woods a little bit and potentially do something I would, regret with a gun I liked, that one goes with me. And I tend to hunt like that a lot. So, you know, so that thing gets a lot of action too. But yeah, I've got a couple other guns I'll take on occasion. I got a nice, I've got a Sterlingworth Fox and 12 that I'll take to the dove field every once in a while, or stuff like that. And grandpa's old 20. So
you didn't get the LC from Mid-South Guns, did you?
Of course I did. Mid-South is. Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. I have to stay away from that place. I don't even go within 50 miles away I'm going to spend money I wasn't anticipating. Did you get to go while you were down here?
Yeah, there'll be a handful of people I talked to that they'll be disappointed I did not go. When I was leaving on Monday, so I could have gone, but I got to looking at maps and I wasn't, you know, we weren't that far from it.
Yeah.
And I would have had to avoid my early start. I would have had to wait around for like 2-3 hours for it to open and get there.
Yeah.
And so,
Means you got a
built in excuse to come back down.
I was about to say the return trip is compulsory now.
Yes, exactly. Yep. All right. Last one for you. If your dogs could talk, what might they say about you as a hunter or maybe your shooting?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I'm a miserable wing shot. So I think, you know, I do a really good job of setting my dogs up for disappointment early in life. But you know, I would say, I think more than anything, my dogs would probably spend more time commenting on how much time I fall down and kind of quietly cuss under my breath in the woods all day long as I'm kind of stumbling around trying to crawl through briar path. I've got a real bad habit of going 10 more feet when I shouldn't and getting myself in situations. So I think they find a lot of comic relief in that. So I often come out of the field wet and bloody and the dogs look better than me oftentimes.
I love it. I'm sure there's a lot of dogs that would echo those thoughts. All right, buddy. Where can listeners go to find out more about your work, training programs? You got your podcast, everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So most of us through, I would say you can find most things just going straight to losthighwaykennels.com. That's my website. I got some links to my social. I'm not great at the self-promote. It just makes me feel weird on the self-promotion end, but I do have an Instagram and Facebook. Everything's under Lost Highway Gun Dogs. And then I do have a podcast, the Companion Gun Dog Podcast. And, you know, I put up an episode sometimes like every month, sometimes a couple times a year. But it's been going on. So, but I enjoy it and it's a good way to connect with the people. So
heck yeah. Well, I was very glad I was able to come down and participate and meet you and a whole bunch of other awesome folks that were at the St. Hubert's trial. And hopefully we'll be able to cross paths again, buddy, but I appreciate you taking the time to join us here on this episode. It was a blast and keep up the great work, my friend.
Hey man, thanks for having me on. The feeling's absolutely mutual. I'm really looking forward to doing it again.
Sounds good, buddy.
All right. Take care, man.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.